Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 203 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. It's only been 2 days since I saw you last, because there was a podcast out on Wednesday. A little peek behind the curtain. I've literally not took a breath since the outro of Wednesday's podcast. Of course, because I'm recording them together. I've not been holding my breath for 2 days. But you can imagine that if you'd like. Am I going a bit crazy? It feels like it, doesn't it? Thanks for tuning in, guys. This little bonus Friday episode, I'm going to do a few of these every now and then. If I've got ones that either are time sensitive or I want to get out as quickly as possible, or alternatively, just that feel like they're good together. So I'm hoping to do an MMA week in a couple of weeks ahead of the Bellator 200 event at the O2. So yeah, I'm trying to... If I feel some work together, I'll double up for you and give you extra treats. It seems to go down well. I've done it a few times recently and it's got a good reaction. So yeah, this week's guest is the wonderful Nick Hawkes. Nick, I've known for a while. Again, I always start these intros and then realise half of the stuff we discuss in the podcast anyway. But Nick's great and he's just started a podcast with Eddie Temple Morris called Trailblazers. And I think the guests they've had so far are Fatboy Slim and Gary Newman. So you can, literally as you're listening, you can click through and go and download them to queue up to listen to later. But Goldie's to come and loads of others. We talk about it in the podcast. What I'm going to do, if you stick around at the end as a little treat, I'm going to play you a little sample from their podcast. And it's going to be of Gary Newman talking about working with Nine Inch Nails. So that's a hell of a podcast. As you'll know, this week is all about the music industry, and I'm from that music industry. Speech of Element Records.com is where you can go and support independent music. You can buy vinyl, that's important. I'm going to tell you a little secret, as this is the Friday bonus episode. On May 12th, it's the 10-year anniversary of mine and Dan Lesac's first album, Angles, which is where a lot of people heard of us for the first time. We're doing a very limited re-release of the vinyl. It's going to be purple vinyl. It's going to be available from speechofelementrecords.com. We're going to be doing 100 and signing them in the web store. There will be a few available from Sunday Best and other places as well, but there will be a limited 100 signed in the speechofelementrecords.com web store. And we're doing a limited edition Mr. Heggie t-shirt. And the design is frankly ludicrous. I'm going to give a little spoiler. It's me and Dan Lesac acting out that scene from Ghost where they're making pottery. So Dan's in front. I'm behind him, topless, reaching round, and we're getting all sexy. So that's super limited. If I get a chance, I might sneak it up early, but otherwise it'll be May 12th. On the 10-year anniversary of Angles. Also, when we will be doing... I'm going to go round to Dan Lesac's house, because Dan has got a Twitch channel. So look into Twitch. Dan's got a Twitch channel. I'm going to go round there, and we're going to spend as much of the day as we can spare literally doing Dan Lesac versus Scroobius Pip. So I'm going to be playing him on computer games, and we're going to be fighting or racing or teaming up at the end, maybe. I want to start with some kind of real... verses, and that'll be a live stream on for numerous hours, and you can come on and chat and you can ask us questions about the record, about our careers, about all sorts of stuff. So yeah, that's kind of the plan there. That's enough talking for now. This is Nick Hawkes on episode 203 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. Right, I'm rolling. I'm joined today by Nick Hawkes. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for, inviting me to...
It's lovely here. Yeah. Where are we? This is... Yeah.
Well, we're at High Road House in Chiswick, so we're not far from... we're in West London, and, just like a nice little environment for our chat.
It's lovely. It's a couple of drinks.
Yeah.
For a chat. And we've got tons to talk about. Our paths have crossed... numerous times over
yes,
the years.
That's right.
I can never remember where or when, yeah. But I always know that we know each other and we've met at points.
Yeah.
The thing that we've come together primarily at this point for is you've just launched a new podcast with friend of the Distraction Pieces podcast, Eddie Temple Morris.
Yes.
And friend of both of us.
Yeah.
But I want to kind of talk about everything. The podcast we'll get into, it's the first two guests you've got, which will have been out when this comes out. You know, I thought I started strong when I launched my podcast. You guys are going all in. I mean, I'll mention it now. You've got Gary Newman and Fatboy Slim to kick things off. So
that's right.
It's a hell of a start. I want to kind of talk about everything. I want to talk about your history in the music industry.
Yeah.
But first of all, the first note I've got at the top is just under a question mark, is Uncle Pat.
Yes.
It feels like the most hyped podcast I've done now. I've mentioned a few times I'm going to be doing a podcast with my Uncle Pat, because he was in the music industry for years and still is, in fact. And he was the first a label manager at Trojan in the UK and things like that. But I remember when I was starting off, it was either the first time we met, or it might have even been how we were first put in touch, was my Uncle Pat kind of said, oh, I've worked with Nick, who started Excel, and did all these other things. And so, yeah, how do you know?
Yeah, how do I know Pat your means? Uncle Pat? Yeah, I know him because my first proper job in the music industry, as in like a full-time proper job, rather than helping out and all of that, was at a company called Secret Promotions, and that was run by a guy called Simon Gough.
Yep.
And we were an independent promotion company, and I did a little bit of radio plugging there, but primarily I was doing club promotions.
Yeah.
So I was the guy that would sit there and we'd get 300 or 800 12 inches of This Is Scar by Longsy D, which is a release that Uncle Pat, as he shall now be known, or the Wing Commander, actually, that some people kind of referred to him as, because he's got this he's a very well-spoken guy. And
I always remember growing up a distinctiveness of he looks like he's wearing a joke. A Groucho Marx, glasses, nose, and moustache. Because but he's got those glasses and a nose and a big moustache.
He's a fascinating guy.
Wing Commander look.
That's right. So I was mailing out these records, doing club promotion, and then in that era I worked on Smith and Mighty, bit of Massive Attack, early days. So this is like Walk On, right at the front end of that Bristol bass thing coming through. And let's think, Turntable Orchestra, Blaze. I did worked on an album that came out on Deconstruction called North, which was all based around the exploding Hacienda kind of house scene at the time. And also did Double Trouble and Rebel MC. It was this sort of era of records. So your Uncle Pat put out the Longsy D, This Is Scar record, which is a crazy, it's a Scar meets Acid record of all things.
Yeah.
And this was in the late 80s. I would think it would be 89, I guess, that I was working there and working on these records. So that was my first kind of real full-time experience of the dance and electronic industry. Yeah.
And what was your introduction to the music industry as such? Because particularly after the boom in the 60s and 70s, the record industry was this hallowed ground, but it was also quite, you know, big labels, established, hard, I'd imagine, almost seen as an unattainable dream in many ways, but you found your way in through luck, timing, and motivation.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, it depends how far you want me to sort of go back. Yeah. But I mean, I've had several kind of moments along the journey where I've done something and gone, oh, this is good. And then I've done something else and gone, oh, this is good as well. Or where you go through door A and you see some other doors and that, and you're walking through door B and you see all of a sudden. So, I mean, at the very start of interfacing with the music industry, I suppose, was when I was a kid and me and my best mate, Andy Smith, started up a mobile disco.
Amazing.
But it was so basic. I mean, we're talking the hi-fi Stacks system from his house and the flat hi-fi thing with a deck and a cassette deck from mine, and four speakers, you know, two with the one hi-fi, two with the other.
Yeah.
And then we'd take these two home hi-fis out and be in charge of a deck each, because of course we didn't have a mixer. You know, so I'd be fading
true live mixing yeah, from ear.
Well, I'd be fading one down and he'd be fading one up, hoping no vary speed. It was very basic. So that was it. But I suppose we did that for the love of it, but then we started to get paid £10 to play at this kid's party or what have you. And so made a little bit of money for doing something that we would have just loved to do anyway, because yeah. Just for the pure joy yeah. of it, which is, and there's a theme there actually that's run on for many years. Really, it's doing stuff that you love, and then hoping that other people love it or like it.
Completely.
And you hope that it brings a couple of quid in
yeah.
to enable you to do more. So that was the first kind of, you know, business meets music thing, yeah. if you like. Yeah. And then I sort of was able to sort of blag a few free records from mailing lists, because I'd run at this mobile disco and I did had a little thing that I did on Bristol Hospital Radio. So that yeah. was my first kind of radio experience, where I used to read the news as a volunteer on this sort of hospital radio thing. And then I got the opportunity to host a show there on one occasion, depping, filling in for somebody who wasn't there. And I was like, wow, this is so exciting. But, you know, and then I was playing all my early rap records and some kind of, you know, some sort of pretty tough American underground club music of the time. And yeah. I actually got sort of yanked off the station. They were like, whoa,
this
mate.
Is, you know, it's a bit much.
It's a bit much. I think we need to return to the smoother,
yeah.
you know, tones of Val Dunican for Mrs. Tompkins, who's had a hip replacement, and I don't think she's quite ready for what you're serving up there, Nick.
It's understandable, but it's all beautiful experience. It's,
yeah, lovely.
It's really interesting what you touched upon there, because it's such a nuanced thing, and I think now as much as any time in the industry, in the record industry, where people will always want something for free, which yeah. isn't acceptable. So you need to know your worth and make sure you're being paid for your work and things like that. But also there is that balance of, I got most of my breaks because I was doing stuff for free because I loved it, yes. just because I wanted to be there. And then that leads on to other things. So it is such, I understand when people get angry about, well, you should pay designers. Or, like if people have a competition, like yeah. a friend of mine had a competition for a design our next band t-shirt.
Yeah.
Quite understandably, a few graphic designers got angry and said, no, you should pay. But their situation was they hadn't really sold any records yet. They yep. weren't really being paid for gigs yet. So they were doing their art for free. Therefore, they hoped they'd meet other people who were passionate about doing their art for free. So it's such a fine balance, isn't it? Because you do need to pick those things to go, you know, I just want to do that. I don't want to price myself out of it. I just want to do it and be involved.
Well, what I say to kids that I find myself in front of when sometimes I'm invited to do guest lectures at a uni or something like this, is I ask them the question. I say, if you've looked at Music Week or any of the other or any of the online kind of music industry publications, how often do you see jobs that you think would be great for you?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is very rarely.
Yeah.
And I say, why do you think that you so rarely see jobs advertised that might be right for you? And they'll be, oh, you know, is it because the industry's contracting? I say, well, that, you know, the shape of the industry might be part of it, but in my experience, I found that I've sort of been offered the jobs before the person that's offered me the job has thought,
yeah.
maybe I need to put an ad in a magazine, because yeah, he's gone, completely. Nick's around, he's helping out, he seems to know what he's doing.
Yeah.
Well, that was certainly the case at Secret Promotions, which we talked about in my first proper gig.
Yeah.
I just helped out. I just came in and did a little bit of helping out around the office, and then somebody left, and Simon said, right, Nick, do you want the full-time gig? Because
yeah.
you're here.
Yeah,
so it completely. Never got advertised, and a lot of the good stuff doesn't get advertised.
Yeah, it's when you just... And often those jobs will have appeared because of you being there.
because of you, that job may have never become a job, but you're there helping out for it. Be cool if we had Nick doing this, yeah. And then that job appears and you become that,
yeah.
That paid person. And it's those opportunities. Are always an example I can give is just as me and Dan Lesak were kind of blowing up and Shout was in the charts, I got an email off one of your guests, Norman Cook, Fatboy Slim, asking if I would record Fatboy Slim Just a Band. So he could play and edit and do it on stage and all that.
Yeah.
At no point did asking for money or payment or anything cross my mind at all. I was like, I just got an email off Fatboy Slim. And on paper, you could say, well, he's a big touring artist. I could say, well, my fee for recording... I was like, wicked. Yeah, man, I'll do that. I recorded it in an hour and sent it over to him and gave a few different versions and edits so he could play with it. And then I had the joy of mates of mine being at Wireless Festival when he was headlining, all sending a video because suddenly...
Mate.
Dave, I used to work with in HMV, is on the big screen because he'd cut the video up as well and do it all. It's like, that's amazing. Yes. As if I'm going to be going, well... artists have to have their fee and their worth.
So proportionally, my lawyer suggests.
Yeah, it was an exciting thing to just go, I'll do that.
And a lot of the very best stuff that happens in art and culture happens because people go, I want to do this. Let's just do it. We think it's good and we think it's worth happening or it's worth being out there. So let's go for it and see where it takes us. I mean, my career has... You know, it's been really important, me doing that. It's not necessarily always about being sort of prepared to work for free, but certainly a big thing for me is putting yourself into situations where good fortune may come your way.
100%.
You know, if you've got the chance to help out in a radio station or and I've got, you know, there's more... examples of me helping out actually at two different radio stations that we can get to, then you do that, and then because you're doing that, it opens the doors and other interesting things happen. And I still believe in that, and that's why I still try to, as best as I can, you know, have the radar up, and I still will go to random things that just take my fancy, because I just think sometimes it just feels like this is all a bit of a weird one. It's a bit left field, it's a bit odd, some event or a TED talk thing or some conference of an area that I'm not exactly involved in, but I've got a mate who's there or whatever it is, and I just go, fuck it, you know, I fancy being there because I've just got a feeling that maybe something good could come out of it.
And that's perfect, because the kind of thing that really... I mean, I'll be quite honest. The thing that put your flag in music history was when you started XL Records and signed The Prodigy.
Yeah.
But again, at that point, in hindsight, it's The Prodigy. It's dance music. It's the biggest thing. At that point, it wasn't the biggest thing. It was something that I'm sure you were just going... This seems interesting. There's something here. It wasn't that, oh, it's a guaranteed thing.
No.
I speak. Oh, you wrote an article recently, and I thought a really good parallel in it was because you mentioned an opportunity you might not have got if you had stayed home and watched Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
But I think within that, there's a great example, because I had one of the Game of Thrones guys on here a while back. And the fact is, in hindsight, Game of Thrones is Game of Thrones. When they all got that gig, there were no big stars attached to it. It was just an acting role. For most of them, it was their first acting role.
Yes.
So again, it was taking that opportunity. That in hindsight, you go, well, of course, if you had the opportunity to be in Game of Thrones, you'd bite the hands off. Well, not at that point. At that point, no one was doing shows about dragons and knights. You may have looked at that. I'm sure a lot of people got that audition through and went,
really?
This seems ridiculous. Fantasy, it's a bit nerdy or whatever else.
That's a specialist thing, and let's it's probably not for us.
So no, let's talk about that kind of that starting point of XL and when the dance industry was just about to explode.
To bubble. Well, of course you are completely right that you often don't really know what you've got until a history kind of looks backwards and then shows you what
yeah.
you had.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Prodigy wouldn't have... I mean, it was fortunate. I think there was two labels that Liam approached. There's a label called Tam Tam, and that's because he was in an act, he was DJ, sorry, for an act called Cut to Kill, rap act. Yeah. And then XL, he approached and he called up cold called the office and approached us because he liked some of the records that we'd put out ahead of, you know, getting involved, some of the Frankie Bones stuff and all of that. So, yeah, on the prod thing, it was a case of accepting the cold call, having a little chat over the phone, Liam saying, can I come in and play you some stuff? And me going, yeah, okay, come in a couple of days' time and let's have a listen. And rather than thinking, it's a rat, look, you know, I could have gone, hey, our policy is please send your demo cassettes in the post. Because I've got a big I would have had a big cardboard box of demo cassettes at the time. Yeah. And that was sort of one of the ways that records were signed, either from the demo cassette in the post or somebody had pressed up a white label and sent it through.
And that kind of remains are the same in a lot of ways. I remember, I believe it was after you'd left XL, but I remember when I've always had great experience of XL with Richard Russell who took over after you left. And I remember going in when me and Dan Lesak almost signed with XL. It was down to our last three or four labels. And I remember going in there and sitting waiting, and there was a big cardboard box that had a load of CDs and a load of tapes and stuff in. And that was that kind of, right, that's still a very hands-on physical thing. It's like, here's some stuff. Admittedly, even by that point, it's not just a you and Richard or you and a couple of others. Mm. It's offices of people who are all going, I'll grab a tape and pop that on while I'm upstairs. But there's still that mentality of, let's have a look at this at some point, you know?
Yeah, and you know, but you don't know what you've... You don't necessarily know what's there. And the music that I heard, I thought was good, solid, interesting, edgy, underground music, and it felt like the right thing to try and sign it and put it out. It wasn't signed... The Prodigy wasn't signed because this feels like smash... You know, there's smash hits here to be had. It was more like, this is great stuff. And, so a simple, you know, deal was done. And we were as I said, Liam only approached two labels, and I was the only person to say, yes, I want to do something.
Yeah.
So there was no competition. So it was really simple and smooth. And that's something that I've also found over the years, that quite a few of the things I've been involved in that have done well aren't these things where there's a big bidding war. And speaking from my experience running record labels, I've done well with things where there isn't a big bidding war and there's 14 labels all trying to outdo each other to sign it. My success is more often than not have been ones where maybe nobody wants to sign it or one other company wants to sign it. And then, when I moved on from XL and I started up Positiva, the track that kind of put Positiva on the map was I Like to Move It by Reel to Reel.
Yeah.
And everybody had passed on that. We were a newish label.
Yeah.
And we were the only ones to offer. And they'd hawked, Strictly Rhythm in America, had hawked that around the established labels of the day.
With no one interested.
And everybody was like, not sure. I wasn't sure at the beginning, but I decided that Dave Lambert, who worked with me, encouraged me to say, hey, there is something in this, you know, I think we should do it. And then I basically agreed. I'm like, actually, you're right, I think there is, so let's do it. But that just goes to show all the experts, so-called experts, got that wrong, and we signed it, put it out, and it was a complete smash. So, you never know.
It's those, the best relationships are those ones where everyone involved is excited to be there. Do you know what I mean? If it has been a bidding war, they've gone to the highest bidder rather than this is where we really wanted to be. With Liam, he'd sent that to two people.
Yeah.
You guys were one of them.
Yeah.
Wherever I Like to Move It.
Yeah.
That'd been knocked back everywhere. So they would have been excited to be part of that.
Definitely.
And my lawyer early on, who I'm sure you must have had dealings with, in fact, Paul Spraggan, also kind of a West London where he was.
Yeah. Well, actually, Prodigy's lawyer also. Yeah,
he put me and Dan with Prodigy's accountant. David McClark.
Yeah,
so
there's been
a huge relationship there. But yes. Paul, early on, number one, he did tons of work for us without charging for ages because we weren't making much money. And he's kind of an adorable hippie in that way, for what you think of evil lawyers.
But his
point early on was like, look, what I'm going to do is a lot of work to draw up a bit of paper that in most situations and the dream scenario is going to go in a drawer and we're never going to look at it again.
Yep.
And that's it. The contracts and all this other stuff. If you're two people who want to work together, then none of that should matter. I'm sure there's stuff that we've done with Sunday Best or that Sunday Best have done with us that has been probably technically not what was agreed in the contract, but we've all wanted to do it,
and
you make it work rather than going, well, we're going to have to renegotiate because
point C says that we can. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and this is where a lot of the magic happens is two people or groups of people going, we both recognise that we bring something valuable to the table here, and we can. The greater good will be better for everyone, we think, if we work together.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, these are the sort of artists that I look to work with, and I'm now an artist manager.
Yeah.
So, take care of Liam, Prodigy, Stanton Warriors, Bad Company UK.
You see, I forget that, because for over 2 years now, me and Liam have been sending disjointed emails back and forth, arranging for him to come on the podcast.
Yes.
I should have just emailed you several years back and said, tell Liam when he's coming on the podcast. That's perfect. It's one of the things I love about the music industry is when people know that there's many areas of it and many facets and many of the skills are transferable. Mm. So rather than going, well, I'm a label manager, this is what I'm meant to do, and I want to go to bigger labels and bigger labels.
Mm.
You can go, well, I know how to do this and this works and I can help in this way.
Yeah.
And you can adapt around the industry.
And now that's, you know, something that's really needed is an adaptive, flexible mindset, because the industry is changing fast around us.
Yeah.
So you do need to be able to morph. And yeah, I mean, I'm primarily an artist manager currently, but yeah, I morphed away from being a record label runner because the market changed, and there was a period where I thought, wow, this has got really hard work. It doesn't really make sense anymore. I need to do something a bit different. So then I started a publishing business and just started to kind of work a little bit in the management area and grew that. And you have to amend, ebb, flow, and be open to new opportunities, and have the radar up and look at stuff and consider stuff, talk to people. I mean, a very important thing to me is the amount of opportunities that come up just by engaging in a random conversation with somebody. And there may be nothing in it on the surface of it, but you speak for a couple of minutes and then, really?
So-and-so
did that? Oh, well, yeah, get him to send it to me because, oh, that sounds interesting. And then suddenly you've found something really interesting, but it's come through a sort of circuitous route, that you might not have even expected.
Yeah, completely.
So very important, I think.
And again, it's that openness and positivity to move on rather than get stubborn and angry. I had had Jimmy Iovine on a few weeks back, and it really strikes me as a similar outlook there of going, rather than going, oh, the record industry's dying. A lot of people in the industry at the time, you have seen as much as I did, were stubborn and angry about, well, no, we need to stop illegal download, we need to stop and do this and do that. It's like, there's certain things you can't stop, so just start moving with it.
Yeah.
Start moving about, start changing it, start seeing what works.
I'm not saying it's easy to do that, though, because 100%. if you've grown up on the value of music and you've grown up with music having a price and a value and generating income, it is difficult for somebody to go, hey, man, just give it away. It's all cool. Yeah. Just and it's not easy to just go, yeah, okay, well, I'll just give a load of music away, and that's what needs to do because I'm flexible. And in my case, is sometimes I've been like slow to, you know, I've been slow to embrace some changes, and sometimes I've gone, wow, I'm not sure I get this.
And I understand it completely.
But then sometimes sometimes it's the right thing to not understand something for a while. I mean, dubstep is an example that I give to people of a genre that I wasn't early on.
Yeah.
I wasn't there when there was 50 people in a basement.
Plastic people.
I wasn't there. Yeah. So
I was there and I didn't get it.
Okay.
Honestly, I was there a few times.
You were a step ahead of me then.
A few of my mates, I worked the door at Plastic People and did things like that. So I'd often go along to see them and I'd stand there and be like, I don't really get this, but...
But you were, play to you that you at least were in an environment absorbing it. I was kind of hearing bits on the radio going, nope, don't get it. And then it was it was a random conversation. Actually, I got chatting to Benga when I was waiting for an aeroplane to go to Miami, just ahead of Miami Music Week in 2009. And I'd never met the guy, but I found myself standing next to him in the queue. And I sort of ended up having a conversation. And he was like, oh, you know, I'm playing this party on Tuesday night or whatever. You should come down, man. And I'm like, yeah, I will. I need to go and see this because I've never been to a dubstep gig at that point.
Yeah.
And then I went down and then I went, pennies dropping.
It makes a world of difference in the room, doesn't it?
Yeah, so then I went, I'm like, whoa, this is exciting. It's vibrant. It's good. Yeah. It makes sense to me. And at that point, then I was like, wow, now I'm ready. Now this is something that I'd like to be involved in some shape or form. And then incredibly fortuitously, Casper was drenched at that point in communication and remixes and gigs and all sorts of stuff because he was right at the heart of that exploding scene. Him, Banger, Scream, these guys were doing great work.
All weirdly, guys, I watched in that basement of Plastic People with hardly anyone there, a curtain across to make it kind of more intimate and dark. And
you check.
But that was a few years of turnover
to get to the point where it all kicked off. And then fortunately, so Benger was saying to Casper, man, you need a manager. You can't do all of this on your own.
Yeah.
And Casper was like, well, I don't know who I should talk to be honest. And Benga said, I met this guy in Miami in the airport or whatever a couple of weeks ago. You should go and see this guy. He seems all right. And Casper called me up, came to my office, played me some stuff and said, yeah, I'm wondering if you might be interested in managing me. And I said, yeah, absolutely. I'm up for it if you are, man. And in that meeting, we basically shook hands and we said, okay, let's go for it. So then opened this, you know, going through one door and another door, whatever. And then the world of dubstep opened up to me and suddenly I'm right in the thick of, you know, arranging Casper touring America. And we went everywhere. Yeah. One of the craziest places was we went to Kazakhstan, for example. So he got booked to play at an event in Almaty. And who's going to end up in Almaty? It's not somewhere that you go on holiday, but they had an underground club there and they were aware that dubstep was blowing up and the local promoters were like, let's bring in one of the leading guys from London. And the offer came through and myself and Gary, and we were like, wow, this will be fun, won't it? Yeah. Got to be done. And so something happened, a random conversation in an airport with somebody that I'd never met, and then something else and something else, and then, you know.
All leading on. It's being open to it. I told you at the start, I've got my notes, and my notes are always in a really logical order, and they make loads of sense, and then I don't look at them and go off on tangents constantly, which is how this seems to work. But you mentioned Benga there, and Benga is someone who, again, I saw in the scene for years and then would see at festivals. Literally every time I've met him, he's thought it's the first time we've met. Because it's a messy scene. It's, you know, there's often a lot of, you know, a
messier for some than others, of course.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, of course. But Benga is someone who I thought spoke beautifully and honestly about mental health in recent years. And I know that you've worked with Calm over the years, as have I and as has Eddie. And it's it's a really interesting one in this industry, because this is an industry that can throw people in, throw them to the top, which can expose them to a lot of potential downfalls, and then spit them out as quick as anything. And Dubstep's an example of that, how huge it was, and then how the drop-off was huge. And
brutal.
Then, you know, so how has that been something that you've found your way into to being involved with and championing and trying to bring more exposure to the dangers of not looking after your mental health, I guess?
I mean, I wouldn't say that I am a massive advocate in that area. I just try and do my bit here and there, really. Yeah. I am aware of the statistics. So even outside of the music industry, this shocking statistic of suicide being the main killer of males in the UK between the age of 18 and 45 or whatever it is.
It's madness, isn't it? Not drugs, not car accidents, not any of these other things.
It's crazy. So I'm aware that there's potential big problems. And I do think, the music industry probably attracts a lot of people that aren't really best suited to being in the music industry, unfortunately. So there's a lot of artists who are very sensitive souls, they are expected to... They're either put on a pedestal, or through the quality of their work, they sort of end up being elevated.
Yeah.
And then they're in a position where, of course, now with this 24/7 online social media world, where whenever they turn on their mobile phone and see what's going on, there'll be somebody chucking a rock at them saying, "You're 100%. Shit," and there might be somebody going, "You're great."
Yeah,
that's difficult for anybody to handle, even if you're really, really kind of strong and tough person. I think that still would be hard.
Yeah.
So
and believing either can be equally damaging. If you're believing all of the people saying you're a god, that can be damaging when you do something that reveals you're a human. And equally, believing the people who are saying you're a worthless piece of shit is going to destroy you. You know, it's mad, because we have this illusion of the celebrity, of the artist, of whoever else. And people often, more so in social media, forget that these are humans. And as you said, this is just coming to their pocket in their phone. And they might have had a rough day, and they're just having I'll quickly look at my phone, and someone is saying, "Fuck you, Dubstep shit," or whatever else, "Your shit," and this and that. It's like, man, it's dangerous. It really is dangerous.
It's tough. And what I think one thing I think that can really help artists is if they just realise that it's, you can manage this stuff rather than letting it manage you.
Yeah.
So there are ways to deal with it. You don't have to be on 24/7.
Completely.
Dip in, dip out. And if you're lucky enough to, you know, if you have a good structure around you, if you have an artist manager who you trust, for example, that can be a great person to say, sort of, give me an overview of what's going on at the moment, because you don't necessarily yourself need to delve into all of the detail.
Yeah, completely.
I
agree, and I think it's something that's really overpushed these days is that the music industry's changed and the artists can do it all themselves, and I think that can be damaging. I think some people aren't built for that, and some people aren't made for that. So the addition of a good artist manager, a good label, a good whomever can really help you take you to that next level. I always give the example of Kate Tempest, who's been a little sister of mine since she came onto the scene, and taking her on tour and seeing her just be amazing and an absolute whirlwind of talent, and seeing what made her break and become big enough to be headlining Brixton wasn't any great improvement in her talent. It wasn't any new song that was such a leap from the previous songs. It was taking on some management to organize her world, to put it all together in one place and go, "Look, here's how we're doing it, here's what we need to do," because a lot of artists are exactly that. "Yeah, I'll do that. Oh, let's do that as well, let's go over there and do that," and you burn yourself out, you detract from other projects because of the amount of projects. And it can be a great addition to have that. The myth that the labels have all died because they were all greedy and they were ripping people off, and now it's just in the parody artists. That's a dangerous outlook at times. And it's one that I came in with. I remember coming in and I was hugely annoyed that when our first single came out, it was in the top 40. We were having meetings with majors and meetings with indies. And some of the indies were clueless. And some of the majors really got what we were doing. Yeah. And that was heartbreak, because in my mind, the majors are just money-churning machines and they're not going to get us artistically, and the indies are the ones who'll get us. It wasn't the truth of the indies. It was honestly down to XL and Sunday Best, and that was it. That really made us go, they get us. They know what we're doing here. It wasn't, and we met tons.
I think you need to go for the great people. Find great people to work with. And it's wrong to think that because somebody works for a major that they're inherently evil, or that they're this or they're that or the other. And the same is true. You know, just because you're somebody at a cool indie, it doesn't mean anything else. It doesn't mean that you're necessarily at this, that or the other. But I think, my advice to sort of young artists, for sure, speak to people, you know, sound them out, try and spend time with them, and try not to turn up to meetings with management or labels or whatever with too many preconceptions that, this guy's all about the money, but this guy's all about the art. Because it's rarely that in life. But definitely, good teams are really important. And again, over the years, I've been very happy to have great teams around me or be part of great teams. I'm not the person who will say, I can make this happen myself. It's all about me. No, it's not. It's about a combination of talents. And you look at the artists who've got real staying power and have really done something that's important, and you will find great teams around them. Now, some mercurial artists might fire their management on a regular basis, and they still are a great mercurial talent. Yeah. But there's not that many really great artists that stand the test of time who kind of take out their frustrations on the management, sack the label, sack this. The good ones kind of recognise that, you know what, we'll have our ups and downs, and the 100%. Label ain't all great, but there's some frustrations, but there's some good stuff, and then they'll figure out. Generally, it's about having good people around you. I had a conversation with Chris Martin, it sounds like a terrible name drop, and Brian Eno as well, funnily enough, in the street once, and Chris was talking about the value of good management and having good people around you, and help the way that can help an artist. And at whatever level you're at, even if you're a grime MC and you've just put out your first thing, if you can get some good people around you, it's going to help you.
So you can focus on what you're doing and what you're good at. Again, in the Jimmy Iovine interview, he nailed it with saying, cast your life correctly. Because if you've cast your life well, you've got the right people around you, you don't mind losing arguments, and you don't mind people picking apart an idea, because it's being picked apart by, in his example, by Dr. Dre, or by this person or that person. It's like,
it can't be that bad. Yeah,
that's a great outlook of, it then is. You don't mind, you don't get stuffed up and go, well, no, this was the idea. Well, it's like, well, no, you've surrounded yourself with great people who can go, I'm not sure if that idea works, and you respect that and can take that.
Well, I think as an artist manager, one thing that you've got to get used to is putting forward your opinion and going, okay, right, this is what I think, and the artist will hear that. But then not being so hung up on your own sort of self-importance that you stick to, no, this is my opinion, this is what it needs to be, because I really think it needs to be. Yeah. Quite often you need to go, this is what I think, but you're the artist.
You're the artist.
So I'm saying route A would be, I think, is probably the best one for us. If you're going to say, Nick, I want to go route C, let's go route C, and I'll stand behind you and alongside you, and we're going to try to the best of our ability to deliver route C.
And that's the key there, to jump in to the route that wasn't your choice with as much passion as you would have jumped into your route, rather than being, well, this isn't what I would have done the whole time, wanting it to fail to prove a point. It's like, no,
go get it.
Once you're on that team, you're on that team.
That's it. So, and I've definitely had to do that. I'd say it's quite a common thing for me to say, I think this will be best. And then for somebody to say, I think this, and then okay, cool, let's do it.
Yeah. So let's rewind back, because I want to get a bit of a history lesson on what was kind of the starting point of Excel, because what I know of Excel is your name and Richard Russell's name.
Yep.
I know that you guys Kicks Like a Mule was you guys putting out your own music and getting in the charts and having that success.
Yeah.
What was kind of the origin of Excel, and how did it build into the monster that it is now? I mean, it's one of the weird ones that it's an indie, but it's an indie that's got Adele and some of the biggest selling artists. It's a major, really. Yeah. It's essentially turned itself into a major. So, what was that kind of starting point for you?
Well, basically, I started working... When I talked about Secret Promotions previously, and then I started working... I left there and started working as a club promo guy for a guy called Tim Palmer, who had a label called City Beat. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that I was attracted to working with Tim and the City Beat label was that when I first met him, I said, hey, it's cool and I'm happy to do club promotions, but if I find a good record that I like that we could maybe sign, is it cool for me to sort of bring it in and go, hey, how about we sign this? To which he's like, yeah, of course, absolutely. Yeah. So I thought, that's great, because that was a step on from working as a promo person,
where
I was kind of getting delivered a lot of finished records and saying, all right, go ahead and promote these finished records. So
now you're getting to scout them a little bit.
Scout them, like when you're a club promotion guy, I did find myself thinking, if only they'd got a different remixer, or if only the radio edit had been a bit shorter. But you're working with a finished product. You might have 1,000 records to mail out, and that it is what it is. The remixer is the remixer. Away you go, Nick. So I started working there for Tim, and then one of the early records I signed to City Beat was a record called Numero Uno by Starlight. And the way I found this record was that Danny Rampling, who's funnily enough one of the guests in the Trailblazers podcast, played it at a club in Maidenhead.
Yeah.
And I was at the back of the room, and I heard this record come on, and I just thought, wow, God, this is good. What is this? Pre-Shazam, pre-mobile, all of that. Sprinted up to the decks. I was like, wow, this record's great. What is it? Peered over. White label, spinning around, bit of writing on it, trying to read it. And it says, fuck off, nosy, on the white label. So I thought, right, maybe I'm not going to find out exactly what it is today. But then I kind of called up Trax Records the next day or whatever, sung it down the phone to them.
Amazing.
They told me, that's numero uno, Nick. Danny Rampling's got one, Trevor Fung's got a copy, blah, blah, blah. About three or four people had got copies of the record. And so we got Trevor Fung to come into our office, played us the record off his own vinyl copy. We faxed, of course it was faxed in those days, faxed the Italian record label an offer. They said, we're happy to sign to you. And the record was signed. And that record then exploded. And it gave me one of the highest points I ever sort of remember in the industry. There's nothing quite like, the first time that you have a proper hit record, because everything's been building up to that point. Being the little kid running the mobile disco or and these other bits and pieces that I did that we might still circle back to when I was working in New York or whatever, blagging my way into places. All of it sort of led up to signing a record that I really believed in and seeing it explode. And I remember listening to the charts being read out, and it had gone in at number 39, and we were expecting it to rise, and it kept reading it up to 21, it's this, up to number 20. And I started to think, oh, God, we must have really messed this up. It must have dropped out
Out
of the 40. Now, But in the end, it was like up from 39 to 17 or whatever, Starlight numero uno. And I was just cartwheeling around this shared sort of student house, really, I suppose, I used to live in those days. And it was amazing. So that, all of that and that success, and it went on to be a top 10 record, enabled Tim Palmer to go, okay, Nick, you've proved yourself.
You can tell
what a hit sounds like. And then I pitched to Tim. I said, hey, well, I think the City Beat is fine, and there's some commercial dance on it and some kind of more soul-y stuff and some rap and all good, but I think we should be launching something that is more underground focused, that's not trying to have hits. And that's a really interesting thing. 100%. It's like, just, you know, I think we should be putting out really good underground records that cater to this burgeoning scene that we've got around us at the moment, the rave scene, for want of a better phrase, that's kind of emerging. And let's just put out really good underground records and build a label identity, and do that, and not be too worried about, in the signing process, thinking, is it a Radio 1 playlist record or not?
Yeah.
And Tim was like, yeah, that's great, let's do that. And that was essentially the birth of XL there. And then I signed a bunch of underground records, and nothing much happened at the front end. A couple of things came out, did a few bits and pieces. And then, I'd signed some Frankie Bones stuff, because he was exploding as this American DJ coming in and playing big parties and making some great records. And that was all evolving and developing, and that was, kind of led to Liam coming in and me signing the Prodigy, and then kept doing what we were doing, essentially, and kept getting better at it.
Yeah.
And then the market was growing all the time.
Hugely.
So you'd have, there probably, if there was some graph, there probably were thousands of new people on a weekly basis getting drawn into this scene who'd missed it 5 months ago, but they'd gone to their first big party, and they were like, wow, this is great, I'm up for this scene, I'm up for buying this music and going to these parties. So that is what happened, and we would sign a record like Anastasia by T99, and you know, really hard edged heavy record, but that would then chart top 15 and Cubic 22, Night in Motion. So, you know, these records started to really deliver big style.
And it's beautiful that that's on a label that was made for not that, for purely the artistic, for finding the right things. Did you find, because it's just come to my head now, but it feels logical that as the Prodigy, for example, blew up, that it pushed some of the back catalogue as well. Some of the back catalogue artists that had just been ticking over, but what attracted Liam and the Prodigy guys and all that, did that kind of see a bit of a boost as well as the scene was growing and growing?
I think so, yeah. I think definitely we got to a point where, for sure, we could put out records in that XL range bag, and people just go, I'll take it, because I trust the label enough to take it blind almost.
And the label was that logo and look, it was kind of iconic of that scene, it was a known, that's what you're looking for.
Absolutely. So it was a beautiful thing to see the way that things could grow from the start point of excitement and passion and a feeling for chasing something that's good and special and all of that, rather than the start point being, how do we have hits here?
Yeah, and again, that beauty of it's something that I experience, and it's easy to fall into that trap. But our first big single was "Thou Shalt Always Kill."
Yeah.
After that, on the second record, even there was kind of, even without too much pressure from the label, obviously there was some.
Yeah.
You start looking at the next record and going, so what's a Radio 1 song? What's this? What's that? "Thou Shalt was never a Radio 1 song. It got played in spite of not being a Radio 1 song. And then the first time I did a solo record on my own label, I went, well, fuck what a Radio 1 song is, and put out Introduction.
Yeah.
And that's the second song in my back catalogue that's had the most plays. Kind of, yep. It was Thou Shalt and then Introduction, because yep. It was going, right, we keep trying to go what would work and what would fit. Just make a what's good, and it'll find its own way.
Yeah, I mean, again, I some people ask sort of me, what is the sort of role these days of a record label? What are the main things that you're supposed to be bringing to the table? Is it A&R, or is it just money these days, or what have you? And something that I always say is that what you're trying to do is you're not trying to give the public what they want.
Yeah.
You're actually trying to find something that they don't even know they want yet.
Completely, yeah.
So do something that's good. I mean, if you'd done a survey of music buyers or streamers, people who stream music or whatever, and said, what is your ideal artist? We're a market research company. Tell us what you want. We're Universal or whoever, and we need to know what you want. They wouldn't have said, well, I want a white-haired ginger kid from Suffolk, and I'd like him to rap a bit. Who's going to say that? Because you've got everything stacking up against you.
Yeah.
But if it's good and it's compelling, then suddenly everybody realises, yeah, that Ed Sheeran guy, he's great. I like him. I want to support him. But they wouldn't have known that so was true. What they wanted.
Completely. It's so true. I always remember kind of arguing that when Lily Allen blew up, because she blew up at a time that it was very male indie dominated.
Yes, that's
the music
right.
scene. And Lily Allen blew up, and suddenly every label was trying to sign a female singer-songwriter. Again, there were people like Kate Nash and Adele who I think were fantastic and came, you know, possibly wouldn't have got as early attention if it wasn't for that kind of rush for those artists. But again, my argument at the time was, well, that's not a solve-all. You know, the reason Lily blew up and stood out was because no one else was doing that, not because everyone was sitting there going, I really wish we'd hear that. In fact, the reason she blew up was because Britpop or indie had blown up and all the labels were going, who's the next Oasis, who's the next this, who's the next that?
Yep.
And people got bored of it.
Yeah.
There was a million bands I like that all of a sudden. So going that route only has a limited, you know, amount of return to it. There's going to be a point where you go, well, now every band sounds exactly the same because you're all trying to find the next Oasis or the next or Radiohead or whoever.
There's, you know, it's fine to try and find the next Oasis, and there was, you know, there was a period with major labels where we saw whatever Duffy break 1 year, and then maybe it was Amy Winehouse might have broken a year later or something, and people were like, oh, she's the next Duffy,
and
that's fine for people to go, hey, this has happened, so can something else happen?
Point.
And that's okay. I don't have a problem with it, but often the great stuff just won't have a queue of people wanting to sign it or want to back it because it's there isn't the history. It doesn't feel. Yeah. I mean, the Prodigy didn't. There wasn't a live act when I signed it. It came after the music.
Exactly. And speaking of not having a queue of people to sign it or wanting it, it must be a hard one to spot. And I mean, a little birdie told me, that's Eddie Temple Morris, that you had four or five, if not five or six demos in from a certain Richard D. James.
I didn't have that many. I had
one. You had one. But again, it just didn't.
Oh no!
Click or grab, but
no, it didn't. Click
will,
for me.
A lot of people will know that already. Being the man that brought the public the Prodigy is a big thing. If you'd been the man that brought the public the Prodigy and Aphex Twin, you know how insane would that have been? But again, it's finding, it's clicking at the right time and knowing what works.
Yeah, no, I've still got the demo cassette that I should have brought it along today. Actually, shouldn't I? Still got Aphex Twin's. Demo cassette.
Yeah.
I can't really say particularly why it wasn't something that I wanted to move on at the time, but I think there was lots going on. I probably had multiple offers out for other things, and stuff was busy with, and you just go, you can't have them all. So again, it's, I'd rather, yeah, focus on the, you know, the good stuff or whatever. I'm not, yeah, in no way do I regret not signing Aphex. I don't think I would have been the best person to sign him anyway.
And that's a wonderful realisation. I have a thing on this podcast often that I'll have people approach me to come on, and I'll turn them down, not because they're shit, not because they're not worthy of the honour of being on the Distraction Piece, but because I'm not the right person to get a good interview out of them. Yeah. It's always kind of, I genuinely, it's not me softening the blow to anyone. It's genuinely, I look at it and go, I don't know enough about that. Or even, it's not an area that excites me enough. Because I don't have to know everything about it, but it's not an area that excites me enough to get a good interview out of that person that they're better suited with. I mean, Eddie's a prime example, because a lot of the dance artists, for example, I've never been that knowledgeable on. So unless there's something in there, a little bit of history or something that twigs or excites me, then it's not right. Whereas it's not the best. Someone like Eddie, who's, again, I always remember learning early on that anyone who detracts from Eddie Temple Morris by saying, oh, he's just over-enthusiastic about everything, he's not. He just focuses on the stuff he's enthusiastic about.
Yeah.
That's the bit that counts. You speak to him, there's loads of stuff he thinks is shit. Yes. There's loads of stuff he despises. But he focuses on the stuff that excites him and has him bubbling over. And it's what I decided to do on the podcast. Hugely influenced by Eddie and by Zane Lowe as well, who's another one that people go, he's so, this is the best album in the world. And it's because like, he can choose and only focus on the stuff that he genuinely thinks is the best.
And you have to create parameters to do some of your best work.
Yeah.
So, and this applies whether you, I think in all fields, actually, whatever it is that you, whatever zone of activity that you choose to be in, some parameters will help you to be great. So a Jack White or whatever just has a set palette of sounds or visual influence or whatever, and works to be the very strongest within that area. And it's the same with, it's the reason that I didn't want to sort of necessarily be someone who worked across a really broad range of acts.
Yeah.
So when I was running Positiva, the kind of EM, a couple of people within EMI, the view was, well, naturally you're presumably going to want to be the head of A&R is your next step, because you're doing great work with all the dance and electronic stuff. I presume you want to do pop acts and rock acts and MOR and the whole thing, right? Well, no, I actually don't want to be head of A&R for EMI. Even if you think that I potentially can be, that's great. And it's just not something that I don't really want to be working with artists that I'm not really passionate about.
Yeah.
I want to put my focus and my energy
as well, right?
I want to put my focus and energy into artists and records that I believe in, that I love, and that I can push forwards, rather than having a big roster to kind of A&R across indie bands and MOR and I mean, I found myself in some unusual kind of situations during the period that I was running Positiva within EMI, and some of it was great. So John Taylor from Duran Duran came in. He had a new album, wanted to talk about remixes and stuff, plays me some new music off the record and have a great chat. And I'm like, oh, you should check this. Oh, great, I will check that. Lovely. So something amazing like that, really cool. But then I also got roped in once into a Vanessa May meeting where she had some new classical album, and like they thought, oh, let's get the dance guy in, because there might be some remixes. And that was not a fun hour and a half. It was awful. So, you know, that's me. No, I like to bring a sort of energy and a passion and hope and do some stuff that I believe in. And then really there's an element of just hoping that others like it. Yeah. And sometimes people won't, and I've definitely had that. I've had artists I've signed, records I've signed. I've really believed that they're great, and I've put a lot of time and energy, and they've come out, done nothing. And, you know, it's that can be frustrating, but at least I can go, well, at least I believed in it, and I
that's exactly
went
it.
For it.
At least it's something that you...
Yeah.
You can be excited about, regardless of commercial success.
Yes,
this was good because I know.
Yeah, at least it was good. Now, and if you put time and energy into something that you don't really believe in, and then it doesn't succeed,
yeah.
Wow, then you look in the mirror and go, that's yeah. kind
you,
of
you don't
that's
really
not
have
great.
To pay off if it succeeds because you're kind of going, oh, this is not
didn't really
that
like
good.
It anyway,
and so on and so forth. And
exactly.
I want to talk about the Trailblazers.
Yeah.
Podcast. I'm going off on all sorts of tangents.
Yeah.
Before we get onto that, I just want to talk quickly because you've spoken of Positiva and your move from Excel over to EMI where Positiva was an imprint.
Yeah.
Kind of in that realm around that time, it's kind of you helped bring Adam F to EMI. And Adam F Chaos, I think, is a classic album with some of the best people in rap. And weirdly, a guy who DJs at my club night, DJ Destruction, worked on a lot of that album with Adam. He also came second place to Liam Howlett in the DMC finals years ago. He's got a tape off the radio of them going back and forth. And he DJs at my club night every month, and I think he's the best kept secret in live DJing. But how was that to kind of bring Adam F over? Because it really was someone that felt like they had the sound of an underground. Being with EMI, suddenly they had access to Redman, to LL Cool J, to huge people.
Well,
that's exciting as a British kind of sounding thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the basically drum and bass was starting to really be vibrant at an underground level. There hadn't been that many crossover records coming out of the scene, but there was definitely an excitement and a sizzle and an energy there. And so I knew that I kind of wanted to do something in that area.
Yeah.
And I'd looked at a few bits and pieces and I hadn't quite figured out sort of or found the right artist. But then I fell in love with Circles, Adam F's Circles track.
Yeah.
And then I heard a couple of other bits that he'd done. And then I went round to his house and he played me just on the keys and then sung a song to me, which became a song called The Tree Knows Everything, which is the Tracy Thorn cut on Adam's first album, Colours. Yeah. And funnily enough, that there was the moment where I was like, yeah, need to sign this guy.
Yeah.
Because he's not just a DJ, producer, knocking out 100%. Club-aimed drum and bass bangers. This is a guy who's got some depth to him because he's going somewhere else or has the potential to go somewhere else. So that was one where I thought he's a great talent, really need to work with him.
Yeah.
And I wanted to sign him album firm to, for the F-Jams imprint to Positiva and then sort of through EMI.
Yeah.
And then, just kind of it was a case of, again, encouraging him to do what he's good at and providing some advice and guidance, some of which was taken on board, some of which wasn't.
Yeah.
I have a wry smile, actually, because I'm just thinking of an anecdote where Adam had his live act kind of developing.
Yeah.
And he really wanted to kind of have a laser at his key shows. I mean, who wouldn't want to have a laser?
If it's an option.
If you're doing Glastonbury or whatever, you know. So at certain of these things, production budgets, what have you, boom. And then he was booked to do a couple of live shows in Japan. And I remember sort of going, mate, we can't, hire a laser out there or take what, it doesn't add up, but do the shows and it'll all be great, whatever. Oh, don't you think there's a way that we could sort this out? We did it for this festival. Well, yeah, but no, I don't think so. And then I remember getting a phone call from somebody. It was like a Sunday morning at like 9 a.m. It was like, Adam's at the airport and there's 2 grand of over additional baggage costs. Are you, Nick, are you cool to put that on the company credit card or whatever? And he'd actually sort of hired a laser himself, kind of split it in amongst the different bags, managed to get it out to Japan Amazing. Without paying anything extra, but then got clobbered on the way back. So I just smile because it's just that example of somebody like, I want it to be the best. I want it to be a great, you know, but unfortunately it wasn't an ideal. It might not have been $2,000. It might have been $7,000or something. But I wasn't best pleased at the time. But it's funny. And Adam's a talent. And then I went on to manage Adam sort of subsequently. So in you know, when I was kind of became more of an artist manager. And he's a great guy, very talented. But, you know, maybe he isn't. He probably is one of these people who I think still has more to give. You know, and
the thing that always struck me with Adam was his ability, as you said, to kind of adapt and dip into other genres, and not just dip in a here's my token hip hop song or whatever else. Dip in immerse. And smash it and immerse. I hold Smash Something up there with Anti Up, with Simon Says, with the true classics of hip hop bangers, and it's up there. And this was at the time from some drum and bass guys in the singles of in the vinyl section.
Yeah, out in Hertfordshire or what have you. Oh, I mean, something that Adam also was good at was again, he would, if he set his sights on doing something, he wouldn't mind waiting around, you know, at the outside the entrance to the artist compound or by the trailer for 4 hours until that artist walked past, so he could go, excuse me, I don't want to bother you, but I'm a producer, and can you just take this, and if you can give me 3 minutes to listen.
Amazing.
That kind of thing he would do. This probably brings me back to, I've touched on it once or twice. I worked in New York for a while.
Yeah.
And maybe it kind of links in, because I found myself working in New York during one of my summer vacations. And again, it's just a bit like Adam doing that, which was the kind of thing he was doing to get a Beanie Man or whoever, or Red or Meth, whatever, on his records. He wouldn't just go, oh, it's up to the record label to, can't you give him another call or fax him to see if he's available. He would go and stalk people to get them on his record. And I just makes me think of New York, where again, just if you can get yourself in close proximity to where interesting stuff is happening, you've certainly got half a chance of something great happening. So
you're opening yourself up for that infamous lucky moment that happened to come. It's like, well, there is some luck, but you put yourself there. You were there for that luck.
That's right. And the reason I kind of want to revert back to this is one of my most pivotal moments in my career actually happened when I was working in New York. So I got a work visa to be in America for the summer, and I got myself a job as a cinema usher in the evenings in Queens. And then I thought, hey, what I want to do, though, in the daytime, I'd like to be working at a record label or a radio station or something, but how do I do that? And I knew that just sending letters off, have you got internships, generally wouldn't work, and I had tried some of that, and it didn't work. So I came up with a scheme, and I thought, oh, I know what, here's an idea. I'll phone up the head of WBLS, the leading black music station in New York at the time, and I'll ask if I can interview him. I'll say I'm writing an article I'm a journalist from the UK, and I'm writing an article on New York radio. Give it a go, right? So I phone up and speak to his assistant, and then 10 minutes later, the assistant calls back and says, come in tomorrow at 10 a.m., Mr. Kirkland is happy to be interviewed by a journalist.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, I didn't expect it to work.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh my God, I'm interviewing this guy tomorrow. I've got no questions. So I need to scrabble this all together. I go in. I do the interview. I am sort of get introduced to the people who run the programming department, who kind of compile the charts and file all the records away and all this kind of stuff. And then that afternoon, I'm sort of help out there. I'm just sort of filing some records, what have you. And at the end of the day, I said to these people, oh, thanks very much. That's really great that you invite me to help out, because I was in the station. It's very kind of you. And the lady who ran the programming area said, okay, so 10 o'clock tomorrow morning then? And I sort of say, it's very confused. I'm like, well, you want to get, I mean, I can come back. She's like, yeah, sure, you're our new intern if you want to be. I was like, wow, I would love to be.
That's amazing.
I would love to be. So then that was how I got an internship at WBLS. So then I find myself, I'm like the kid, like Marley Marl is in there doing his lunchtime mix, and I'm the kid going to, hey, Marley, what sandwiches do you want today? Do you want any soda? I'll nip out to the store.
Love it.
Doing all of that. So I'm kind of in there, and I went round to Marley's house, actually, funnily enough, his studio at that time.
Wow.
This is 1987.
Amazing.
So really just, you know, he was, anyway. But the pivotal moment hasn't happened yet. The pivotal moment is when the promo guy from Epic comes in and goes, hey, walks into the programming office where there's about three or four of us work and go, guys, new Michael Jackson album coming up, world premiere, playback party, it's in a few weeks' time. Who wants to go? And he's got a handful of invites to the world premiere of a new Michael Jackson record. What I thought at the time. I thought, Jesus, what am I supposed to do here? So I'm in the corner, and I sort of very sheepishly sort of like raised my hand slowly, and I was sort of wincing on my face, like, I don't know whether I'm supposed to be raising my hand or whether I'm allowed to, but I'm going to do it anyway and see what happens. And the guy was like, yeah, you're a good kid. You can come. Pop. And so, like, a few weeks later, I'm on this massive super yacht that's sort of circling Manhattan. It's champagne, caviar, and then all of the, you know, I asked some of my WBLS people, I said, who are all these people then? And they're like, oh, that's the guy who, he's the editor of Billboard. That person runs Tower Records or whatever. And basically, me... I was a uni student.
That's the intern from that. No other interns.
I don't think so. And that was me, and I was between my second and third year of university at that point in the summer holidays, and I just was on that boat. I mean, I thinking this is amazing. I know that I shouldn't be here, but I am.
Yeah.
And I knew in my mind, I could work out the steps that had led me to be. So I wouldn't have been there if I hadn't been working as an intern at BLS. Yeah. And then I wouldn't have been working as an intern at BLS if I hadn't done that little, you know, did the interview thing.
Yeah.
So I could see the steps that had led me there. And I said, I know I shouldn't be here, but I am. And at that point thought, well, I don't know if I can ever have success signing a record that might become a hit or running a label or anything like this, because it all seems a bit far-fetched. I was like, I wonder if I can even get a full-time job in the music industry. I wonder if that's possible.
Yeah.
Seems a bit far-fetched, but it all seems far-fetched. But this is far-fetched.
Yeah.
So maybe it is possible that those things could happen because I'm here and this has happened, so maybe it will.
It puts it all in the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
I've had numerous points like that where it seems ridiculous to imagine that, but a year ago what happened yesterday would have seemed ridiculous and things like that, and it just makes it realistic. It's a beautiful thing because so many people in the music industry have got these amazing, unusual and unique stories. And your podcast, Trailblazers, which is on Deezer, is going to be getting to the bottom of a lot of them that haven't been told, with guests like Gary Newman, Fatboy Slim, Goldie, who's been on the podcast here.
Yeah.
They've all got a wealth of amazing stories. So was that kind of the motivation of doing Trailblazers, of picking these absolute icons of music and going... because again, they're all icons of music who had their peak or heyday when radio wise it was 2 minute interviews, a quick plug, and that's that. Not really a storytelling moment. Whereas the rise of podcasts has been after their heyday, but it means you've not got these in depth stories and these beautiful colourful tales of the industry. So was that kind of the motivation of Trailblazers?
It wasn't the case that we felt. First of all, it wasn't like we need to get these big name, iconic sort of legends, first and foremost, because I think Eddie and I both realised that there's a lot of great stories with all sorts of people
everywhere in the,
yeah.
The industry.
So these are the big names, but we've got Renart, who started RNS, and of course he was the guy who signed the Aphex Twin. You know, so we've got Renart, Daniel Miller from Mute Records,
and
these stories. So there's people who don't have the same public profile as a Goldie or a Fatboy Slim, but also have but they do have amazing history.
And I mean, there's evidence of that in this conversation that we've just had, because obviously you know within the industry and you've got your point in history, but it's not rude to say, I don't think, that a Goldie or someone else, you know, they're more of a public name and a big name, yet
absolutely
you've had numerous insane stories throughout your career, and we've touched upon only a handful of them here. So it's a great example of all these other people in the industry who it's such a rich history in there
that needs
to be documented.
It needs to be documented, and it's also something that's just really worth doing anyway. I mean, fortunately, they are. It's myself, it's Eddie, and a guest, so it's a kind of three-way conversation.
Yeah, perfect.
So that's really interesting because it isn't just sort of, and what did you do then, and then what did you do afterwards? Because it has the flexibility for Eddie to say to Gary Newman something, and him to say, oh, this and that happened. And then I might chip in, that's funny you should mention that, because something similar happened to me, actually.
It's what excited me when I heard, because I'd heard that Eddie was thinking of a show like this, and as soon as he said that he was doing it with you, it felt perfect, because it is exactly that. You've got a seasoned pro in interviewing in Eddie, in being the man to get the right question at the right
Absolutely.
Time. But then add in someone else who's got those experiences and will know a lot of these people and will have seen them on a party of a launch album and things like that over the years.
Yeah.
It really adds something that's more than just, again, it's the beauty of podcasts, that it adds something that's more than just a radio interview. That's not just a, here's something that would have been on the radio, but it's on a podcast now.
Yeah.
It's like, no, this wouldn't have existed anywhere else.
No.
It's perfect for that podcast.
Yeah, though. It is. And so thoroughly enjoyable and worthwhile. I mean, for any of these people that we've spoken to, I've been keen to do it anyway, just whether it was recorded or not, I would be keen to have those conversations just myself, because I want to hear, I want to learn, 100%. I want to absorb, and I'm still learning, and I'm still consciously aware that I've still got so much to learn, even though I've been whatever in the industry for a while and all of that. There's still way more that I don't know than that I do know. And so I know that if I spend a couple of hours with Danny Rampling or DJ Zinc or whoever, I'm gonna go, oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. I will be surprised. I'll be surprised and sort of entertained and educated by those conversations. So they're worth doing for me anyway. But then, of course, hopefully that other people will be entertained and educated as well. And that's, it's a little, with this podcast series, it's not dissimilar in a way to sort of record making. We're involved in doing something that we think is worthwhile, that we enjoy, that we believe in, and now we're just at this point now where we've got the first couple out, and we hope that people will like it, in the same way as you sign a record or whatever, you put it out and you sort of hope that people get something out of it as well.
We're happy with it, and we've achieved everything that we need from our side. Now, hopefully, the cherry on the cake is going to be that other people like it as well. And it's the perfect outlook. I maintain that despite having a wonderful, a loyal listenership who give amazing compliments on some of the podcasts that I've done over the years, no one has got more from these podcasts than I have. I've got to have these conversations that I wouldn't have had otherwise. The stuff I've learned, the people I've got to sit down with. And that's the prime motivation. And it's why people have learned that it's not just about the big names. It's about all the names. Because if I've agreed to it, there's probably a reason. There's probably something exciting to be had there. And that's kind of what, yeah, it means we've got a strong listenership to the entire back catalogue rather than just Goldie or just a Russell Brand or whomever else.
Yeah.
And it's a similar thing here. There's the names that I've looked on the list that I've gone, I need to hear that.
Mm.
But there's also that awareness of, well, if this guy's on there, I don't know who that is, but if he's on there, there's probably a good reason. So that's maybe the more exciting ones, because they're there not because of their name. They're there because of their story alone. So if their story alone has put them on the level of Fatboy Slim or of Gary Numan, it's going to be a hell of a fucking story.
Yeah.
I
love biography and autobiography. Yeah. Those are my favourite kinds of books, and they're my favourite kind of films, really. I love the richness of human experience, yeah, and I love meeting new people and having... I've met lots of random people over the years, people who've done unusual things, weird stuff, and I'd get chatting to them on a train, and it's almost endless. I remember sitting on a train once, and the guy, I was at a table, and the guy opposite me was writing stuff on House of Commons notepaper. I thought, oh, that's a bit odd.
All right.
And I hope you don't mind me asking, is that I just couldn't help noticing, are you involved in that? Oh, he said, oh, I'm an MP, actually, and got chatting and this, that, and the other. And this guy, actually, you know, he was as interested to hear about my experiences in the industry and working with the acts and all of that as I was to, tell me more about
how that
your experience is. And again, random things like that. So I love hearing these stories, but parameters, like I said, can be a good thing. So instead of Eddie and I going, let's just get a whole bunch of people and hear their stories, we've gone, no, let's look at people who really have pioneered in the dance and electronic area, and let's hear what they've got to say. And like you said, and document it and let it be there forever, that these people have all in different ways helped sort of build the scene that is out there and has touched so many people.
Completely, and it's beautiful because it's the timelessness of podcasts and this series in particular. Again, it's not like you're going to be discussing what happened on the news that day.
No.
Therefore, once it's up there, whilst there's a release schedule, there's ones that you'll push at appropriate times, they're there forever. And that's the beauty of it, is these stories just continue and they're archived and documented.
And there are so many amazing stories out there. And so much of it is random. It is that Daniel Miller just could have found himself in a sort of pub gig environment, could have nipped out to have a burger, but thought, oh, I've got no idea who this support act is, but I'll hang around, I'll hear one song, and then I'll decide whether I'll nip off out, because he was there to see a different act. And he stayed for the one song. Oh, this is pretty good. Stayed for the second song. Oh, all right, I need to hear the third song. Third song, even better than the first two, and that was Depeche Mode. And that was it. And he was just like, wow. And then there you go.
Yeah,
it's
beautiful. It's those moments that the slightest change, it could have changed,
and
literally changed the course of music with no exaggeration.
Yeah,
there.
And or certainly his life, because if he'd got there and thought, I know what I need to do. I need to go out and get a plate of spaghetti now. The artist that I'm here to see is on at 9:05. I'll get back at 9:00. It would have been so different. So there's a lot of this out there. And like I said, though, there's a lot of this in music, and there's a lot of it in life in general, these random things. I can't stress enough to young artists, certainly, you know, to young artists, this whole philosophy I've got of just putting yourself in these environments where at least interesting and positive things have a greater chance of happening than if you if you're not there.
If you go off and yeah. get that plate of spaghetti. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'll end it there as we're on the 90-minute mark. And in the outro, I'm going to play a little outtake from, or a little sample of one of the Trailblazers episodes.
So oh, lovely.
Can get a little taster and teaser of the stories and what that is all about. So thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thanks, man. Pleasure. No, it's been a great pleasure for me too, so thank you.
Thank you, man.
You've been listening to Scroobius Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Nick Hawks. Man, I know this is already a long episode because we really got into our talking and we wanted to go longer and longer. And I rambled a bit in the intro. So, as I mentioned, Trailblazers is available now. Let me just hang on. I've got a specific bit of. It's always good to be as accurate as you can, right? With these details. So I will let you know that. Hold up. Yeah, you can listen to Trailblazers at Deezer.com, Deezer.com, on the electronic channel, with new episodes released each week. I mentioned Deezer briefly in the episode where we're going to get into that a lot more because it's exciting, all these new platforms coming up for things. But yeah, Trailblazers is at Deezer.com on the electronic channel. So check that out. And of course, next week, we'll obviously just back to Wednesday. I'm just doing one, probably. I might sneak a bonus, but probably just one. And it's Jamali Maddox, who a lot of people are hyped about. It's one, again, a guy that I was really excited to meet because it felt like I knew him because I'd watched every episode of his series, Hate Thy Neighbour, on Vice. So yeah. Jamali Maddox next week, and then loads of good stuff to come, trust me. We might have to get a drunk cast in soon, too. It's been a good 4, 5, 6 months, isn't it? All right, I'll work on that. But Trailblazers is at Deezer.com on the electronic channel. As a little teaser, here is a little sample from it. It's what we're going to end on. They're chatting to Gary Newman about working with Nine Inch Nails. Madness. I'll see you next week, guys. This has been episode 203 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. And this is Gary Newman on Trailblazers.
Those very cool analog synth sounds that, of course, we all take for granted and that everyone's got on soft synths now. But they, like you say, you fell out of favour. And a lot of people fell out of favor at that time, and there was one person in America who was, when everybody was going, oh, the 80s and all the sounds from the 80s are shit and let's not use them, let's use 90s or north, whatever, let's use more current sounds, Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails was the custodian, wasn't he, of those analog synth sounds, and he just kept that going and used it in such a visceral way. And he's well documented on the cover of Time magazine, you know, decades ago, as the most influential man in music today. And I know that you're friends now, and he, you know, that must have, you know, must have been very inspiring for you when you what was happening, or where were you when you first heard Nine Inch Nails, or you first interacted with this amazing music?
I was downstairs in my room, in my little 12-track studio still. I just started to see Gemma, and Gemma was upstairs playing music.
Where were you geographically at this point?
Essex.
Essex, okay.
Yeah. Lived in Essex near Stansted Airport.
Okay.
And I heard a song called Head Like a Hole came on, and I ran upstairs to Gemma and said, what is that? That's just like the best thing ever. You know, and it was just, it's song to die for, you know, it's got the best chorus in the world, you think, And then he's got another one.
Yeah, he hits you with another one.
What? You know, any song in the world, you know, the two best choruses in the world are both in the same song. It's just amazing. And so, and then through Gemma, Gemma introduced me to Depeche Mode, Songs of Faith and Devotion. It had escaped me. So she introduced me to all of this stuff that completely reshaped where I was going. And the Nine Inch Nails thing, you know, it was a real eye-opener. I'd realised how stagnated I'd become. You know, I was doing all this. I was doing all these cool sounds and thinking differently and, you know, and going off on these different paths. And somewhere along the line, lost it all, got corrupted, got famous, got corrupted, lost it completely. Really ashamed of myself, really ashamed. And then I heard Nine Inch Nails and I heard Songs of Faith and Devotion, and I started to work on my own stuff again, and it was heavy and dark and I loved it, and it was, when there's all this music I'd never heard that was incredibly inspiring, and just absolutely born again.
What would you have done, do you think, if you hadn't had that pivotal moment? Were you starting to think, you know, okay, maybe I'm going to drive a cab, did you think about doing work outside of the music industry at that point?
It was a serious possibility, yeah.
You could have been a pilot. You could have worked at Stansted Airport.
Loose.
Sorry, yeah. I am here all week.
yeah, short drive.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.